Good morning, folks. Can you hear me? Thanks for joining us. I was concerned that we'd get a light turnout here, given the fact that the House Energy and Commerce Committee tried to preempt us this morning. Did anyone go over to the House hearing this morning? They probably had a pretty light turnout. The other thing we were thinking about doing here was set up some spy cameras and monitor what's going on in the spam and spyware panel. But we didn't have the technology. Nothing good over there? I think we're going to launch right into Q&A and discussion and not waste time with introductions or bios. I don't know that the three of these folks need much of an introduction. None of them gave me their bios. So it's funny because President Bush or Bill Clinton, they wouldn't give me their bio. They are simply the president or ex-president of the United States or well-known entities. But I think in this community, these three are fairly well-known entities themselves. James Assey from the minority staff of the Senate Commerce Committee, Mike O'Reilly, Sununu's counsel, and Chris Libertelli, Chairman Powell's senior legal advisor. I want to make sure that the audience has the opportunity to engage on the right subjects. I come from telecom and now an IP communications background, so my focus is going to be probably a little bit more limited than a lot of the folks in the audience. So if we're not focusing on the issues that are important to you, seriously, raise your hand, interrupt, do whatever you can to get the floor. But I'm going to launch right in. This first question is to Christopher Libertelli. Chris, I was a big fan of the Vonage order as a member of the IP communications space. I thought it was very important for you not to allow excessive state role, too much, subjecting IP communications to a whole host of state and municipal rules. One question for you, though, is, isn't it somewhat presumptuous of the FCC in one breath to say states, municipalities, this is not really your domain, you have no jurisdiction, this is a global phenomenon? Frankly, it's an intergalactic universal phenomenon, but what gives the FCC the right to claim jurisdiction over something that is in fact bigger than any one nation?
I suppose that's a fair question, and part of the Vonage decision recognized that UIP services are globally interconnected, but I think it's important to keep in mind what the Commission did do in the item, which was exercise its regulatory jurisdiction, but in an unregulated fashion. That is, the idea was the Commission was going to claim this space as a way of preempting traditional telecom regulation. We fully recognize that if a state regulatory environment, or even if a federal regulatory environment, is hostile to VOIP services, there's nothing that would prevent a VOIP provider from moving offshore. I can recall a meeting that we had with Level 3 some time ago where we asked them, how quickly could you move your operations away from the federal jurisdiction and locate yourselves in some island in the Caribbean? And they said that they could have the whole system up and running in a matter of 7 days or so. So I think the order does recognize that any assertion of jurisdiction is going to be confounded by the boundless nature of VOIP services, and for that reason, we established a principle of regulatory humility. There are only certain things that a regulatory environment can do and do well. We think those things include things like establishing a unified E911 system or preserving universal service, but I think we were mindful of the global nature of the service.
James, I didn't mean to prejudge the role or lack of role for state and municipal entities. I don't know if you care to weigh in at the moment on what you might view as an ongoing role for states or municipalities in the wake of the FCC's Vonage decision or the prospect of federal legislation that might carve out a role for states and municipalities.
Well, I think we're trying to feel our way on that a little bit. Is it on? Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. I think we are trying to feel our way a little bit as far as what is the proper role. I think what Chris said is right. I think the Vonage order, as I view it, was focused on dealing with a particular problem, which was a concern that state regulators were kind of going to get out in front and create a crazy kind of patchwork quilt. I think what we're seeing here is that the technology is necessarily changing the nature of the federal-state partnership in how we deal with communications regulations. There are going to be some things that are going to require more uniformity, more central control, more attention at the federal level, and there are going to be some things that the FCC just doesn't want to do, shouldn't do, I mean, that are you know, that we should reserve a role for the states. And we are now trying to feel around for, you know, what goes in what category. I think those issues are also teed up in commission proceedings that are ongoing as well.
I'd like to delve into that in a little more detail in a moment, but first I want to get some of the process issues out of the way. After the Telecom Act was passed in 96, the battle lines became pretty firmly established. There were, you know, the incumbent phone companies on one side, the long-distance companies, and the new competitors on the other side, cable somewhere in the middle or on one side, depending on the battle. And there were huge concerns over parity issues and to what degree should wholesale access to the Bell network be provided to the new competitors. With the emergence of IP technology, do you see the battle lines, the alliances evolving, emerging, moving in a different direction? And I'll throw that out to both of the congressional reps if you have any thoughts on how it's evolving. My general sense is that everyone last year, most of the sort of the IP community, those who profess to speak for the IP community, were sort of speaking off the same page. They were saying, don't regulate the Internet. Don't regulate the Internet, however, may mean different things to different people, depending on where you are, the sorts of facilities you own, the power you hold over a consumer, et cetera. So my question is, do you see that sort of evolving? How does the fine print flesh out this year, depending on where you are on the hierarchy of network access and application versus facilities layer control?
I'm happy to take that one. In my experience, suggests that the lines that may have formed or were existing in the 96 Act, that didn't seem to come into play in our experience. There were a number of different folks that had nuanced decisions or approaches to our legislation or my boss's legislation. But in general, I think the providers there were of a similar mind that the commission has been working on and things that were very complementary to the work my boss has been doing. So I'm not sure that the old lines that people talk about, or even if there are current lines, are that pronounced as much as they are more nuanced than they are strict battle lines.
I mean, I think you touch on one point maybe going forward that, you know, it's not an epiphany, I mean, because enough people have said it, but certainly you are, I think, going to see increasing tension between the folks at the edge, the application providers, versus those who own the facilities, who own the networks. That is kind of one of the great liberating points of IP, that someone can provide a service who is independent of the person who owns the network, and we want to promote that because of the greater competition that encourages, but that also takes us back to a lot of thorny problems that we dealt with in the 60s and the computer inquiries. And, you know, those are very difficult, intractable questions that are also teed up over at the FCC as well.
Chris, sounds like you had a...
Yeah, let me just follow up on what James was saying. At least from the Commission's perspective on this debate between who's arguing for what and why, James is right. We do have a proceeding that looks at the ongoing Computer 2 obligations of facilities-based providers. What's unclear to us at the agency, at least at this point, in terms of what we hear from the IP community, is whether that's really the debate that the IP community wants to engage in, or is the question the imposition of some kind of net freedom or net neutrality principle. The Commission certainly has proceedings that can deal with both of those kinds of regulatory requirements, but back in the 60s, as James mentioned, there was this intuition that the more ISPs you had, the more openness you'd have, the less discrimination that would be present on the network, and the more competition would be present. It's not perfectly clear to us that the market hasn't moved forward such that principles of net neutrality and what my boss refers to as net freedom are more relevant to preserving openness on the internet. What our goal is in these proceedings is to preserve the openness of the internet, to keep it a open platform for innovation, because no one provider, certainly no one government agency, knows with clairvoyance what the optimal innovation strategy is going to be for all these interested parties, cable operators, incumbent LECs, application services providers. So our approach is to impose a light regulatory touch that empowers innovation and allows each one of those providers to innovate and doesn't unnecessarily stifle any kind of entrepreneurial activity at all different layers of the protocol stack.
Yeah, I think the three of you hit on the crux of what I think quite likely will be the focus of the debate at the FCC and on the Hill going forward. It seems to me that some have basically made the term common carriage a bad word. And others have promoted the concept of ensuring network access through either a rigorous unbundling regime or something akin to computer inquiry rules. Others have talked about perhaps moving away from that structure by the adoption of, Chris, you pointed to, the net freedom concept. This next question is a toss-up question. Don't forget to frame it in the form of a question. I want to read a quote from someone. And I want you to tell me who it is. This person said, "The entire broadband industry should take heed of how critical unfettered access to the Internet has been and will continue to be to the success of the Internet. Consumers have a high expectation that such access will continue and the benefits to them and the nations and the nation are significant." Anyone care to hazard a guess as to who said that?
You.
I did read it.
That one. That could be either Commissioner Copps or Chairman Powell.
Excellent point, Christopher. That's the point I wanted to make. That in fact was a quote from Chairman Powell. You probably wrote it. I have a follow-up quote. "I was pleased to read the recent speech by Chairman Powell setting out some key principles of Internet freedom: the freedom to access content, use applications, attach personal devices, and obtain service client information. It is, I hope, a sign that a deeper discussion may finally be starting and that we may be developing consensus around the idea that there may just be some problems here after all."
I mean, it is notable that Commissioner Copps and the chairman are at least at a very high level together on this concept, and particularly the folks who are looking at Telecom Act rewrites. There is an evolving sense, at least at the commission, that there should be some insurance policy against the behavior of vertically integrated providers so that those vertically integrated providers don't, for example, block ports, which would make it impossible for a unaffiliated VoIP provider to provide the service.
Yeah, maybe I can jump in here, and I don't mean to do quotes for most of the day, but I remember a testimony from Chairman Powell before the Senate Commerce Committee where he indicated, you know, and outlined what you just described, Chris, but then he, you know, indicated that it's something we want to be, you know, monitoring and being diligent about rather than taking any specific action. As I remember, his testimony didn't have any specific plan in mind. So I'm leery to, you know, I think, and I think we're leery to have presupposed the end result before we have actual an issue, and people say there is an issue, and I think your last quote indicated you think some people think there is an issue. Well, you know, we're happy to listen to the folks, and I've met with most of the people probably in this room, and we'll continue to meet with anyone that is involved in this debate. But most of that part, I think, in Chairman Powell, at least when he testified before us, was that there's something that is not occurring at the current time, and we want to be diligent about it.
That's right. And just typically, we don't see it as, you know, a reason to launch a broad rulemaking, but rather increasingly we're thinking about this as an enforcement focus. That is, if someone, an interested party, were to bring facts to the commission that demonstrates that, for example, port blocking is occurring, then that's probably the best context in which to decide these issues.
Yeah, I guess for me, the heart.
How do I do that? Not when my ISP is blocking my port 25, what do I have to do to bring the matter to the commission?
Set up a meeting. I'd be happy to meet with you.
Good. Is that an enforcement action? Does the FCC have the tools at this point to actually engage in a relatively expedited enforcement action to resolve David's concern?
We think so.
What makes blocking Port 25 illegal or enforceable?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly some work to be done on the complainant side to demonstrate there's a legal theory to justify a complaint moving forward at the commission. But, for example, if there is port blocking on the DSL platform and DSL services are offered, at least the underlying DSL services offered on a common carrier basis, you might argue that consistent with the Carter phone line of cases, port blocking is inconsistent with those established precedents. I'm not going to make your argument for you, but it will certainly be a case of first impression. But as I said earlier, the policy is one that there's an increasing sense of consensus around, at least at the Commission, and working through the specifics of any individual case and the legal theory that supports the result is something that the Commission and the outside parties would have to work hard on.
Well, Chris, that does seem to beg the question, would the root of that challenge be centered around Title II common carriage obligations like computer inquiry, or is there a Title I information service hook that would guarantee an end user this sort of guaranteed access?
Yeah, I don't think we know the answer to that question, Ben.
Let me jump in, though. I think it does highlight, what I love about communications law. I mean, Chris was mentioning this, harkens back to Carter phone. And I was in a meeting with somebody who's been in this town for a long time and seen a lot of the statutes, and we were talking about some of these issues. And I said, but isn't this the same thing that we kind of went through with Carter phone and that we went through with the computer inquiries? And he kind of looked at me and then replied in deadpan, "Yeah, but we all got to eat." It underscores, I think, how intractable some of these problems are. We have some very smart people at the commission downtown on the Hill who wrestle with these issues of trying to promote network openness, yet preserve the network operator's right to protect the security and robustness of its network. 50 years from now, we'll probably still be wrestling with them. The challenge for us is to try and parse through the new technologies and get a snapshot of what's really going on.
I think we may be assuming a lot of very deep base knowledge among members of the audience. Is everyone, folks here, familiar with the Carter phone case and its progeny? For those of you who aren't, essentially, it was the initial, it set the tone, that, along with the computer inquiry and the Hushaphone case, established the basic principles that consumers should be allowed to attach computer devices to the end of their telecommunications connection, and established the distinction between telecom services and information services, most recently or historically the difference between basic and enhanced services, with some degree of regulation of the basic telephone connection and essentially no regulation of the enhanced application riding on the telecommunications facility. And this is where I think IP brings it all into focus. It seemed to me for 40 years the FCC had the vision, the foresight, to recognize the distinction between the telecom transmission facility and the enhanced applications that ride on telecom transmission facilities. I think that line was, in fact, historically much blurrier at a time when IP technology did not exist and you could not actually disintermediate the voice service or the voice application from the telecom transmission on which it rides. Now it seems to me we finally have the moment where the vision of computer inquiry or Carter phone or Hushaphone actually comes into play. And there does seem to be some movement now that we actually have a circumstance in which the enhanced service or the information service can clearly be separated from the telecom service or the delivery vehicle, seems to be more of a pushback in doing away with the inquiry that is not, that finally makes some degree of sense in a disintermediated facility layer versus application layer analysis. Do you think I'm missing the point on something, or is there some reason that we to suggest that we finally realized the wisdom of computer inquiry?
Well, I think that's kind of what some of these proceedings at the FCC are teed up. You know, I'm not going to prejudge that issue, and I'm sure Chris won't want to either. But yeah, I mean, I think your point, you know, ultimately, I think we all recognize that at the services level, we at least have the opportunity, if everyone plays fair, for kind of abundant, robust competition. Maybe the focus changes to the network facilities layer to see whether or not there is abundant competition at that layer, you know, and we focus on, as we do in antitrust, particular markets, particular geographic areas, particular products. People smarter than I luckily have that task.
Well, let me give you two stark examples then. One IP video, one IP telephony. Let's say you've got an unaffiliated IP service provider doing voice or video. Let's say they're doing voice. They don't control any of the underlying telecom transmission facility, but they're providing a voice service for a fee to an end-user customer. Do you guys have an opinion on whether or not this voice application riding on an ILEC or cable network or wireless network is A, telephony, B, information service, C, something else, D, it depends, E, none of the above, or F, Congress may have to make a determination this year?
I hope not.
This is a hypothetical for you, Jonathan.
What's that? This is a hypothetical. I want to see if we have any...
I thought my law school exam was going to be the last test I was going to have.
I think, look, the answer to the... I think it was B, I'm not quite sure, but when you're talking about a peer-to-peer telephony application, which is computer-to-computer, the commission answered that question and said it was an information service.
Provided it was free.
That's true, although one wonders whether the statutory analysis changes significantly if it was for a fee. That's an open question. The Vonage scenario, which is an interconnected service, which is not peer-to-peer, yes, there's a regulatory question about what label you put on its forehead, but the real question is how Vonage and its interconnected partners are going to pay to haul traffic around and terminate it on the PSTN. The most underappreciated proceeding at the Commission right now is the intercarrier compensation docket. That is where the rubber meets the road. That is where you're going to get some regulatory stability, and that is where the Commission should announce its intention to move to a unitary compensation regime that looks more like peering that's happening on the Internet and less like the access charge system, which is probably more appropriate for 1934 than 2005.
All right, Chris, following up on... Oh, I'm sorry, Mike.
Can I answer it this way? And maybe it's just the different hats that we wear. I haven't worked at the Commission, and maybe never will. But Congress doesn't have to live by the structure that is set up in the 1934 Act. It has an opportunity to change that as it sees fit. And my boss was comfortable in answering a number of questions as it pertains to IP, especially in the IP voice scenario, and not trying to say it is an information service or it is a telecommunications service. You come with a number of baggage. When people say, oh, we need to oppose computer one or computer two, the principles behind that are one thing. The other is the actual regulations that go with it. And so parts of them, maybe everyone maybe would agree with or maybe wouldn't agree with. But there are also parts of that that people wouldn't agree with. So then you get in the world of, you know, parsing out parts of existing regulations and should they apply based on the definition, based on the classification. Well, we were uncomfortable trying to, you know, live within the Commission's restrictions. And so I'm not sure that that's not the best. It, you know, if there is an issue that needs to be addressed, it can be addressed. What the burden should be, that's something that the Congress can define. It doesn't need to live with the current restrictions of an information service or a telecommunications service. And I think they're squarely at our doorstep and need for our action.
Well, you beg the $64,000 question, which I think everyone asks every time it's a congressional panel. Is the statute broken? And if so, does it require a broad overhaul of the Communications Act, or is there are there minor modifications that might be sufficient to allow for deployment of new broadband networks and new technologies and services?
Well, I'm happy to take that. I don't want to, you know, claim the statute broken. It's not for me to say. My boss is comfortable making the case that the existing statute didn't fit with the viewpoints that he wanted to see as a going forward basis for a legal framework for IP, is in that case IP voice. I defer to James in terms of, you know, the committee, how they plan to tackle it or something to that nature.
Well, I don't think the statute is broken. I think as all responsible legislators, it's incumbent upon them to, you know, do a spring cleaning and try and look at, you know, what's working, what isn't. There is a Section 10 that's probably one of the least or one of the most underappreciated sections that was added, I guess, as part of the 96 Act, that does give the Commission the ability to kind of fine-tune the dials if the regulatory obligations that are set forth in Title II no longer fit the marketplace. And, you know, it's an open question. I go back to kind of where we were a few questions ago. I don't know that there's a whole lot of debate about where we end up. The debate is over how we get there and how optimistic we are that, you know, there's, you know, abundant and rampant competition already today, or whether we maybe want to take a more careful and measured approach. I think obviously some of you probably were here this morning. I think Senator Stevens probably outlined his vision for looking, revisiting the 1996 Act, trying to ask a lot of questions, get a lot of information, really trying to strike a balance between a lot of these competing interests.
Chris, Section 10, is that sufficient?
Section 10 is an extraordinarily significant part of the statute and allows the Commission to essentially unwrite any statutory requirement that's in Title II of the Act if it finds that the statutory criteria, which are not easily met, are in fact met. But on the broader question of whether the Act is broken, it's a statute that was primarily designed to address analog telephone competition. If you ask consumers whether, for example, long-distance rates or international calling rates are better today than they were in 1999, most would say yes. Average calling rates for long-distance services in 1999 were between 10 and 11 cents a minute. Today, they're down to 7. Average international calling rates in 1999 were 52 cents a minute, and today they average around 20. So for the purposes it was designed, for the goals that it was designed to meet, it has had a demonstrable effect at increasing consumer welfare. It's the question is whether it's ready for the increased convergence of networks and networks that provide IP services instead of analog circuit switch services.
Chris, you mentioned intercarrier comp. I don't think you called it third rail, but you did point to it as the most, probably the most significant related issue at the FCC, that along with perhaps universal service. I'd like to talk about them in turn. First is, in the intercarrier comp front, what would you imagine to be a successful year at the FCC? I know they've had the issue on their plate for 8 years. Is there potential relief this year? Is there action this year that you would consider a bona fide success by?
Yeah, look, there are clear benchmarks for success in this proceeding, and I'll just give you my take on what those outcomes look like. What you need to have out of the Commission, or if Congress decides to jump into this mix, we need to have an intercarrier regime that looks more like the peering model, more like a bill and keep model, than the traditional access charge structure. It has to provide for a unitary rate structure, so you remove the arbitrage opportunities between federal and state access charges and local recip comp rates. And to the extent, and there clearly are universal service concerns that are bound up in this proceeding, you can't talk about intercarrier comp without talking about the burdens that rural companies face in providing service to high-cost areas of the country. But the response there should be explicit and portable mechanisms so that consumers benefit from the universal service program. The program should be one that is designed to benefit consumers and not producers of telecom services. Those are the kind of benchmarks of success that we think about. It remains to be seen whether that's something that the Commission can complete in a timely fashion. This is going to outlast certainly our tenure at the Commission. One industry group has suggested the beginning of the reforms beginning in July of this summer. There are other plans, particularly those sponsored by the Expanded Portland Group and others, that would propose different transitions. But there will be transitions. All of them will take multiple years. The charge of the Commission is to get on with it, and that's what we hope to do in the very, very near future by starting the proceeding.
By very, very near, is it tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Universal service, first an FCC-specific issue, and then broader universal service, national scale issue. Is there a similar activity at the FCC that you expect might advance the ball on the universal service front? Can we expect an order anytime within the next few months specifically addressing changes in the collections?
Right. This would have to come with a grain of salt because, again, it's most likely to outlast certainly our tenure in the chairman's office. But my sense is that there's a fair amount of support at the Commission for a revision to the way providers pay into the fund. And the solution that's often talked about is contributions based on active telephone numbers. That could come down the pike in a matter of months.
I'm trying not to editorialize. I've been tasked with being as impartial as possible. But I do have one question about universal broadband. Both President Bush and then-candidate Kerry had pieces of their platforms devoted to ensuring something akin to ubiquitous broadband for all Americans, either by 07 or 2010, what have you. America's obviously fallen from 12th to 13th and doesn't look to be moving up internationally in broadband penetration. Some have suggested that preservation of a narrowband universal service regime has, to some extent, thwarted the ability for the desire of Americans to actually adopt broadband as a preferred delivery vehicle. Do you see any movement in Congress and the administration at the FCC that might promote a more favorable environment for universal broadband adoption?
I'll tackle that to start anyway. I'm not sure the Congress can answer universal broadband, however you described it. But one thing that is helping to facilitate broadband, at least if I hear from the folks that I talk to regularly in the industry and to consumer groups, is, if you want to talk about VoIP, has been very helpful in leading people towards broadband penetration. And I've heard from other folks that some of the independent, or if you want to call them independent folks, or non-affiliated VoIP providers are facilitating broadband penetration for some of the facility guys. So there are going to be some mechanisms that Congress can look at, but a lot of this is going to be decided in the marketplace.
I think it is a laudable goal. I think we certainly need to be doing everything we can because there are significant economic benefits to getting everyone hooked on to broadband. Recognizing that it is a long process, we need, I think if history teaches us anything, it's that we've had the most rampant kind of innovation and build out when we have had aggressive competition. And to the extent that Congress can focus on measures that will promote such competition, I think that will get us closer to our goal. We're going to be exploring a number of things and strategies that we can do to provide, broadband to the masses as quickly as we possibly can. A lot of that may be through, regulatory policy. Some may be through, concentration on basic research. and networking capabilities, which in a more competitive market, you know, you don't have the luxury of maybe a Bell Labs, and maybe there needs to be a more aggressive federal involvement in research. But, you know, these are, I don't say that as an answer, I say that as a question, and it's something that I think it's incumbent upon the Congress to really take a hard look at.
You know, on the flip side, while there may not be that much movement in devoting the resources to universal broadband, there has been some movement at both the municipal, the state, and the federal level on taxing broadband and IP services. And most recently, there was a joint tax committee report from Congress that set forth three possible mechanisms to increase to cover the federal revenue shortfall. And among them were a $2 billion tax on VOIP or an $11 billion tax on broadband. Do you think, I guess it's for the folks in Congress, do you think that has any legs, the concept of taxing broadband or VOIP, or was it just sort of something thrown out there for discussion? Do you think there might be a better a movement to tax the services, or perhaps a movement to actually roll out the services, you know, establish a federal fund to deploy along the lines of the National Highways Program from the 50s? Do you think they could sort of work simultaneously with one another? One is taxing and one is spending. Will the government be spending more? Will the broadband industry be a net recipient of revenue or a net payer into the government coffers?
I'll tackle the start and from there. I haven't read the report you talked about or the recommendations. I would just suggest that people make recommendations every day. I do, and many of them are not very bright, and they die quickly. I don't know about this one. My boss hasn't been a big favor of taxing VYP. We're certainly willing to talk to anyone who want, you know, and hear arguments. It's a very thoughtful debate, but we had a very long and successful process on internet access debate on the Senate floor, and suspect that will come back at some point. So I'm not sure the attitude of the Congress is to impose new taxes. And on the funding side, I'm not sure. I'm not a budget guru, but there may be some difficulties that we're going to struggle with on the budget side that may prevent such a national highway trust fund scenario.
I think that was a revenue options piece, you know, which Congress often does. You know, if how could I possibly raise money? And let me approach it this way. I don't know what the answer is. Obviously, you know, we don't want to burden technologies with unnecessary taxes. But I think we all need to, you know, take a breath and maybe approach some of these questions a little bit more pragmatically, because to the extent that, you know, IP services are going to compete with circuit switch services, I think there's some argument, at least, for fairness and for competitive neutrality. And at what level, I'm not going to make that choice. That's going to be something that's up to Congress. But I think, you know, if you're a mayor or you're a city or you're a state and you're looking at trying to be even-handed, those are the types of issues you're looking at.
A question for the audience?
Raise your hand if you're not. Uh-huh. This is a very small.
We know you're not shy.
Go ahead.
So I'm raising my hand. I had two.
Cheryl, do you want to identify yourself?
Oh, yeah, I'm Cheryl Lamb. I'm with the National Labor Committee. I just had two things that I would hope the panel would address. And one, James, you started to allude to was we clearly have a situation in which the earlier process was to have a dominant, almost monopoly or monopoly provider of service, and we had some broader public policy goals that we were trying to achieve, and we achieved them through that provider. And now we have services coming from, some of them from the same old providers that offering different services. We still have those same, presumably the same public policy goals that we had before. I don't think the country is abandoning the idea that everyone should have access in some way that universal service is a goal, that a certain amount of localism is a goal, that public safety is a goal. And in dealing with this new, in this world where you have these new providers, I'm just wondering if you have developed a way that you're thinking about how this is exactly this competitive, perhaps, imbalance. If the new world is all going to be on the internet, then how is the internet going to be completely deregulated with no taxes, owing no obligations to anyone? Do we just then let all the people and all the services that we have for the citizens of the country fade away because now everything's on the internet and that is a deregulatory place to be? I think, 6 years ago, ironically, when everybody talked about the internet was a footnote in the 96 Act, almost 10 years ago, that was a... That was a non-service. That was a service that nobody thought was unsure whether it's going to succeed. I don't think anybody questions today that now almost all commerce is going to happen on the internet. So I just wondered if you could address some of those issues. And then later on, I would actually really like to hear a little bit from the folks about the process that Senator Stevens and Senator Burns mentioned this morning in terms of a little bit more detail about the listening tour, if that at all be
helpful. Yeah, I'm happy to start with the dialogue. You rattled off a couple different goals. If one of the goals is revenues, that's something that Congress has on its plate. Congress decides should localities and states tax interstate services. And my boss is very comfortable that voice and a lot of these IP services are an interstate matter. And so Congress can answer that. Now, if your goal is revenues and you should get X amount of dollars, well, that's something we have to put in context with what's the, earlier question of penetration rates and, adoption rates and what is the impact on that. If it's you need to maximize the exact dollars that you have today, then I think those dollars are eroding, notwithstanding whether we do anything or not.
I guess maybe following up on what Mike said, Cheryl, what we do is we adjust. And we do it the best we can. What you teased out there was, we can go back to Theodore Vail. That was the compact. Give me the monopoly and I'll provide you the service. And the cities and the states have had similar contacts with similar providers. We're not in that world anymore. Congress wisely, in my view, abandoned that in 1996 because they believed that competition would provide consumers with a greater number of benefits. Now, what has to shift then is maybe the role is one of, it's all balancing the costs and the benefits, but I think what the struggle is to determine, well, a competitive market will bring consumers benefits, but it will also potentially create some risks, and maybe there is a government role for some level of consumer protections. And maybe we ought to focus on that as well. As far as the revenue, I think, you adjust. And we're trying to approach these things as pragmatically as we can with the goal of trying to, instill some measure of fairness in the process. As far as the listening tours go, I don't know that I should add anything on what Senator Stevens commented this morning, except for the fact that I know that Senator Stevens and Senator Inouye are working very closely on this, and they are interested in having a series of kind of full and frank discussions with people to really understand the galvanic changes that are going on in the marketplace today, and trying to read the tea leaves about where we should go tomorrow.
Forward to working with the chairman and have a great relationship, and we'll look forward to whatever structure he lays out in the listening format or however it was presented.
Chris, any thoughts from you on what the IP-enabled world looks like with regard to a government oversight function to guarantee the social good that we've grown to expect from the monopoly providers?
Well, certainly the tax question is above our pay grade. We deal with common carrier regulations under Title II of the Communications Act. So our oversight role is, of course, constrained by the statute. And what we did in the IP-enabled services proceeding is essentially started a dialogue with Congress and the industry. We've identified a set of core social values, including universal service, including providing access to law enforcement for lawful surveillance, and there are a number of others. That's the way we think about it. Those are the interests that we're trying to serve in an IP world, and they are enduring. They're no different than the ones that we saw in the circuit switch world. What's wrong about calling broadband telephone service is that it reflexively imposes all sorts of rules that have nothing to do with those goals. And so what we're trying to do is be intelligent about only regulations that serve discrete ends, the ones that we've identified, should be valid. Anything else falls away.
The inverse, I think, of Cheryl's question is that, I think her concern is rightly focused on the values of consumers, ensuring a place for consumers. What about ensuring innovation and entrepreneurship and innovators? You look at sort of the failed history of a lot of technologies. A lot of folks have bemoaned the fact that, beta failed. TiVo may be failing, at least as a company, if not a technology. Bluetooth. Is it going to survive? Is it not? Wi-Fi seems to be catching on, but there's been some pushback from at least the wireless industry to try to thwart its growth because of the potential, initial revenue hit. Low-power FM, what have you. Is there a role for government in ensuring the deployment and adoption of, innovative technologies and services?
I mean, I think we do it indirectly through promoting competition, and that's probably the best thing we can do. Yeah. Did you have a question?
I was just saying, Jonathan, wouldn't you say that there's an example already there with the promotion of digital TV?
Digital TV is a great example. There's been some government push to roll out digital TV. Some are afraid, have been bemoaning its slow development and the give back to the broadcasters, etc.
Look, there's a long history at the commission about incumbents trying to stifle the introduction of new technologies. You can go all the way back to FM radio back in the 30s, and that tradition continues today. The digital television transition is one that just needs to be managed. It's about making sure that the process moves forward incrementally as consumers adopt more speedily and as the price of sets come down. But that process is actually moving forward fairly well. We think that the last holiday season was a real breakthrough moment for the cost of digital sets.
As a follow-up, Jamie Hood with Microsoft, a larger question of competition in the broadband space. Is the spectrum management, freeing up spectrum, talking about innovation in the unlicensed space, I think the FCC has done some pretty remarkable things in the recent past to really bootstrap type things in the industry. Certainly the Wi-Fi development is really exciting. The DTV, a huge challenge, with the white space proceedings. Are there other things out there that you're aware of that potentially could provide that third robust competitor for a broadband solution to the consumer market?
Can I take a stab at this one? I think the 3650 proceeding at the commission, unlocking more unlicensed spectrum at 3.6 gigs is the right way to go. That's the holy grail in that environment is a kind of tri-mode phone that roams across, typical Wi-Fi networks onto other higher power Wi-Fi networks and is mobile. We unlocked 290 megahertz of spectrum for unlicensed devices over the last 2 years. It's part of the solution to the universal service problem, right? I mean, we hear the same thing from rural WISPs who are providing VoIP services in places where it's very hard to reach with a wired network. That has to be part of the toolbox to solve the universal broadband problem.
Yeah, I would agree. I think we've been strongly favorable towards unlicensed spectrum and been working with the commission on this front. To your question, I'm not sure, to Jonathan's question, I'm not sure there is, it depends on the situation, I guess, but, when I think of Bluetooth, is there a role that Congress should have promoted Bluetooth by endorsing it and spending money on it, for X amount, for X purpose, or I don't know the answer to that question, but it seems to violate a number of different things.
Mergers, I'll take a question from the audience.
The one is the first one is how do you see the relationship between the industry dynamics? Like a recent case of SBC AT&T mergers, I think my understanding is correct that the inter carrier compensation issue came up after the breakup of the AT&T. That is the system to compensate from from ISPs to the local carriers that has the physical access to the end users. Now the HPC and TNT, just one entity, has both the ISP function and also the end user access. So it seems to be that in the long term, that seems to be that the industry dynamics is going back to the dark age, that the inter-carrier competition issue may be becoming less issues. Although in the imminent issues, there are more than 1,000 local carriers all over the country, so there needs some kind of reform or competition system for the certain time, for the future. That is my question. What is, how do you see that kind of relationship with the reform of telecom act and some specific schemes and industry evolution? And the second question is, how do you see the telecom act reform the position in the low spectrum of this White House and government now pushing very hard for the next 2 years is obviously like social security reform issues or tax code reform or some other issues. Already he mentioned that the State of the Union address, and he's going to push very hard in the budget discipline issues and the fight and the sunrise.
So
how do you see the relationship between those pictures of telecom reform.
So first question is sort of the blending of AT&T into its former child, losing one, the elimination of one long distance provider. Does that somehow change the dynamic in the inter-carrier compensation debate? Now, one interesting point is SBC will now probably become a net payer of access. Does that change their position pretty dramatically? Now, I think you're envisioning a day in which there is, in fact, complete vertical integration between the local and long distance, and that may be, this may be the year that that happens. But the question, I guess, is, does the merger of a single local and long distance company of on such a grand scale eviscerate the need for inter-carrier comp reform?
No, it doesn't. I often, think just because these problems aren't hard enough, we had to, pick them up at a time when there's this rapid shift that's going on in the industry. I can't say how positions will change one way or another, as SBC merges with AT&T or other entities merge as well. We'll just have to take them as we see them in addressing some of these issues. I think inter-carrier compensation reform and universal service reform, if they're not the most pressing thing on the plate at the FCC, they're pretty close. Partly because the technology is advancing and increasing the substitution that has been going on for some time, but it's probably now even ramping up even further. So we're getting more and more pressure. I know we're going to start another NPRM tomorrow, but in some level we've had a contribution methodology proceeding over at the FCC for over three years, we've had an NPRM open for four. So I'm hopeful that whoever the next commission is, that they will devote their full attention to this problem, because I think it's so central on a going forward basis for whoever providers are, whether they're a married, Bell company and an IXC or Rural LEC or whoever they are, having some predictability and being able to project what the rules of the road are going to be is essential as we move forward.
Just a quick comment on the SBC AT&T piece. What's fascinating about this is that AT&T and SBC agreed on a solution to the inter-carrier compensation debacle before their merger, right? So when their interests weren't aligned as part of this agreement to merge the two companies. And they agreed to essentially a bill and keep regime that was phased in over a period of time. This is the ICF group's proposal. It remains to be seen whether the commission can have the courage of its own convictions to adopt a proposal that looks something like what these IFCs and, in this one case, SBC have agreed to. A bill and keep structure is definitely the right way to go, and we'll see if we head down that path in the near future.
Does the merger of AT&T and SBC make your jobs easier or harder? I think it could cut both ways. I mean, they've clearly been about the two most vocal and the two deepest pockets on either side of a controversy. Does it become easier for you folks to sort of blend what's the appropriate conclusion, or does it make it harder because you don't have the same access to industry lobbying muscle to help you formulate the best solution?
It doesn't change. I don't think it changes my job. I mean, it obviously changes who the players, I guess, are in the game, and they change the positions that they espouse. But the issues are the issues, and we have to take them as they come.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know what I read very little on the proposed merger, so I couldn't tell you if it's going to change positions. I don't know. But in terms of does it make our job any more difficult, I couldn't tell you. This has been a pretty tough hour in and of itself. So, I couldn't speculate right now. We listen to I meet with and talk with all interested parties on the issues that come before the committee. So if there's combined entity, we'll probably have fewer people in that meeting, and we'll have different meetings then.
Well, it's noon. Are there any more essential questions? Paul?
Just a short one. I also missed the session this morning, and I spent the last 2 weeks sitting through a proposal to telecom act reform. I guess my question would be, what's the situation on the ground, I guess, since it would be the mic chance, as far as the likelihood of any kind of comprehensive act that's found for this? Really comprehensive rewrite or even any addressing of ICC and USF issues before the FCC moves on at its own pace.
Where were you the last 2 weeks? What are the odds for telecom reform? I can't answer that. I know the House is signaled that they, have an interest in moving aggressively. We will probably follow them, but we're going to go through this process where we're going to try and have meetings with stakeholders, listen, try and learn, and decide, I guess, at that time whether, how broad or how narrow we want to focus on. As far as the intercarrier comp USF question, I think Congress is, will grow impatient if we're not able to make, firm progress on this question, particularly because it's stood out there for a while, and also because the inability to kind of, as I said, figure out what the rules of the road are kind of bottling up some of the other issues that maybe folks might want to address in any type of reform. Obviously the issues related to IP video, that's a whole other subject we haven't even touched upon, but those are something that we all need to become more educated about. And there are a number of proceedings at the commission that will hopefully flesh out some of the issues and give members of Congress a preview. But we'll just have to see how quickly we progress. But we're certainly headed in the direction of trying to come up with legislation.
I would echo a lot of that. I think my boss looks forward to working with the chairman and James's boss is co-chairman. My boss, I can echo what my boss has said, and that is that he believes that there is going to be, and he wouldn't call it a rewrite as much as it would be a new document, going forward document for this age. And he has said that he imagines that almost everything will be put on, you know, will be part of that, given that, you know, when you talk about inter-carrier compensation, the commission is going to start something, if I understand that correctly, is going to start something soon and not expecting to conclude that, you know, the next day. It's going to take them a little bit of time. So whoever is not feeling comfortable with that will, you know, or loves it or whatever the case may be, I suspect it'll be part of our plate. And so imagine this will be a you know, everything will be discussed. Now, whether everything gets included or not, that's for the chairman to decide, and we'll work closely with them. On the IP front, my boss plans to be very active on this and has indicated that he will re-energize his effort last go around and probably broaden it in scope, but does plan to be very active on the IP front.
All right, thanks, folks. Lunch is in the ballroom. I'd like to thank our panelists, and my hope is that we all determine that there's more that unites us than divides us going forward.
Name it when you need it.
So, what are the softballs, Scott?